Okay, let's unpack this. Close your eyes for a moment and think of a TV show or maybe a movie that just feels like home. Maybe it's that kind of comforting nostalgia, you know, a 1950s diner vibe. Or maybe it's that dazzling, totally improbable romance, like a modern Cinderella story. Chances are, if you're picturing something warm, something funny, and just utterly unforgettable, you're probably tapping into the legacy of one particular, really extraordinary individual. Today, we're diving deep into the world of Gary Marshall. He was the creative force behind some of the most enduring, most beloved stories in American entertainment. A true master who didn't just tell stories, he like built entire universes we all love to live in.
Indeed. And what's truly remarkable about Gary Marshall, I think, is that he wasn't just, a director or just a writer or a producer. He was more like a foundational architect of popular culture. He really shaped our collective memory of entertainment for decades. So our mission for you, our listener, is to go beyond just like listing off his incredible credits. We want to truly explore the how and the why behind his, well, his unparalleled success.
Yeah, get underneath it a bit.
Exactly. We'll connect his early experiences, his unique insights, to the bigger picture of his career. We'll try to reveal that deep-seated creative DNA, that allowed one person to master so many different facets of storytelling, from joke writing all the way to iconic sitcoms, then blockbuster, romantic comedies, and even the stage. We're going to try and uncover what made his touch, quote unquote, so distinct and so enduring.
And what a rich foundation it was to start with. Gary Kent Marshall, born November 13th, 1934, right in the vibrant heart of Manhattan, New York. You know, you often look at these really successful creative people and you wonder about their formative years, right?
Yeah, where'd it come from?
Exactly. And for Gary, it feels like his destiny was almost like woven into his immediate family environment. His father, Anthony Wallace Marshall, his name was originally Mascarelli. Before they changed it, he was a director of industrial films and a producer.
Okay, industrial films. Interesting.
And meanwhile, his mother, Marjorie Irene, she didn't just own, she actually taught at a lively tap dance school. Can you even imagine growing up in that kind of household? It's almost like a perfect storm of influences for a future entertainment mogul.
It absolutely is. And it's really critical to kind of dissect those influences a bit. Think about the father's side. Industrial films. Okay. Maybe not glamorous.
Right, not Hollywood blockbusters.
No, but that realm, it demands precision, clear communication, project management, and a real understanding of how to convey a message effectively, efficiently. So Gary would have seen the meticulous planning, the logistical challenges, the importance of a clear narrative, even if it wasn't fiction.
Right, the nuts and bolts.
Exactly. This isn't just about making movies, it's understanding the business of production. Then you layer on the mother's tap dance school.
Totally different vibe.
Completely. That's pure performance, rhythm, timing, immediate audience feedback, the discipline of rehearsal. It's about bringing joy, creating a spectacle, understanding physical comedy, movement. So blending these two, the practical, structured, behind-the-scenes production stuff from his dad, with the live, vibrant, audience-focused performance art from his mom, it gave Gary this incredibly holistic, almost, paradoxical education.
Yeah, like two sides of the same coin.
Precisely. It offered this rare duality, the technical side of filmmaking and the spontaneous human element of performance. This, I think, undoubtedly fostered an inherent understanding of what grabs an audience, how to manage all the different parts of a production, and, crucially, how to marry them into something cohesive, something entertaining.
That's a really fascinating way to break it down. It's like he had this two-track education right from birth. And it wasn't just his parents. That entertainment gene clearly ran deep in the Marshall family.
Oh, God.
He had two younger sisters who also became pretty formidable forces in Hollywood. Penny Marshall, of course, who became a renowned actress and director in her own right, directed huge hits like Big and A-League of Their Own.
Classics.
Absolute classics. And then Ronnie Marshall Hallin, who was a successful television producer, you can almost picture those family dinners, can't you?
You really can.
Probably a lot of laughs, maybe some impromptu performances, definitely talk and shop about show business. It really seems like a family just deeply entrenched, almost like predestined for the entertainment world.
Well, the presence of Penny and Ronnie in entertainment isn't just, a fluke. It really reinforces that idea of the household being this fertile creative ground. And it raises an important question, I think. How did this family environment, so steeped in performance and production, How did it specifically shape his collaborative nature later on?
Good question.
Because you see a lot of creators who maybe struggle with delegation or trusting others. But Gary Marshall, he seemed to absolutely thrive in collaboration.
Yeah, that's true.
So one might theorize that seeing his family operate almost like a creative unit, watching how different talents could combine and complement each other, maybe that instilled in him this intrinsic value for teamwork, for ensemble building.
Makes sense.
It might have made him more comfortable with that dynamic give and take you need in a writer's room or on a film set. And then you add his heritage Italian on his father's side from Abruzzo, combined with his mother's diverse European roots, German, English, Irish, Scottish.
A real mix.
A real melting pot.
Mm.
And that could have contributed to a broader, maybe more inclusive perspective in his storytelling, letting him craft characters and situations that resonated with a really wide audience. It's not just about what he learned. It's about the values he soaked up, family, collaboration, and this kind of rich tapestry of human experience.
So beyond that incredibly rich home life, Marshall also meticulously honed his skills through formal education and maybe surprisingly for some, even military service.
Right.
He went to DeWitt Clinton High School, then on to Northwestern University. And while he was there, he wasn't just studying. He was already, you know, putting pen to paper.
Uh-huh.
He wrote a sports column for the Daily Northwestern.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah. And he was in the Alpha Tau Omega fraternity. Now, writing a sports column might seem a bit removed from sitcoms, maybe.
Yeah, not an obvious link.
But it points to an early knack for, like, concise writing, capturing energy, engaging an audience a lot like a good comedy script needs that precise timing. And the fraternity stuff suggests a social, engaging personality, someone who gets group dynamics, crucial for comedy, right?
Absolutely. That sports column, it required quick wit. The ability to find a narrative in real-time events. That's actually excellent training for comedy writing, where you're often pulling humor out of everyday situations.
Stoink.
But the real sort of game changer in his early professional development, like you mentioned, came after college. He served a stint in the U.S. Army starting in 1956.
Right, the Army.
He wasn't on the front lines, but he was using his storytelling and organizational skills in a pretty high-stakes environment. He was a writer for Stars and Stripes and Seoul News, and crucially, he was the production chief for the Armed Forces Radio Network in Korea.
Wow, production chief in Korea.
Yeah. This wasn't just some brief detour. It was a really foundational experience. Imagine him there running a radio network, writing for military papers. This is where he went from just honing his craft to actively applying it in these diverse, challenging, logistically complex settings.
That's incredible pressure.
Totally. He learned mass communication, leadership, how to adapt content for a specific, often captive, audience. It was basically a pre-Hollywood boot camp that taught him not just storytelling, but leadership, execution, and how to make content resonate broadly, you know, regardless of the medium or the subject. He was already a producer, a writer, a communicator on a pretty significant scale.
That's incredible. It's so clear he wasn't just passionate about entertainment. He was actively building those muscles from a really young age in all these different challenging environments. And after those formative years, Marshall made his way into the professional comedy scene, back in New York initially.
Right.
His first career path was as a joke writer for comedians like Joey Bishop and Phil Foster. That's a classic, often kind of brutal entry point into the industry for comedic minds, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Trial by fire.
Totally. It's where you learn the fundamentals of comedic timing, structure, in the most direct way possible, making people laugh on demand and night after night. He even became a writer for The Tonight Show with Jack Paar.
Wow, Paar. That was huge then.
Massive platform, operating at the absolute peak of late night TV. This period must have been crucial for understanding the raw mechanics of humor, where, like, every single word counts.
It's an incredibly demanding apprenticeship, like a comedic boot camp, as you said. For a joke writer, you're not just funny. You're a craftsman, a wordsmith. You need this acute ear for language, rhythm, the precise moment for a punchline.
Yeah.
You're learning to write for a specific comedian's voice, capture current events wittily, constantly generate new material under immense pressure. Working for someone like Jack Paar meant understanding the national comedic pulse.
You had to know what people were laughing at.
Exactly. And that constant feedback loop. Did the joke land? Did it get a laugh?
Mm.
That's the bedrock upon which all his later success was built. He wasn't just learning to be funny. He was learning the engineering of comedy, the intricate process of how you build a joke, how you build a scene, how you build that audience connection. This really honed his instincts for what truly resonates with a mass audience, a skill he deployed for the rest of his career.
And this early success, you know, proving his mettle in that high-pressure world of joke writing, it soon led him west, out to Hollywood. In 1961, he made the move. Initially, he partnered up with a writer named Fred Freeman.
Okay.
Together, they broke into sitcom writing on The Joey Bishop Show. But Hollywood, you know, it's a town of constant change. Freeman eventually decided sitcom work wasn't really for him and went back to New York. But Marshall, with that characteristic persistence, that adaptability we keep seeing, he found a new collaborator, Jerry Bilson.
Ah, Bilson. Now, that's a key partnership.
Totally. This partnership proved incredibly fruitful and really defined a lot of his 1960s TV writing career.
Huh.
They worked on this string of popular, beloved shows, including The Dick Van Dyke Show, The Joey Bishop Show again, The Danny Thomas Show, The Lucy Show.
Wow, that's a Mount Rushmore of classic sitcoms.
Right. It's quite a resume right there. A masterclass in the golden age of sitcoms.
Yeah, that period with Jerry Bilson is absolutely pivotal for understanding Marshall's development, especially as a showrunner later on. The length and the sheer quality of the shows they worked on, it just demonstrates this powerful synergy.
Mm-hmm.
What made their partnership so effective, writing-wise? Well, they were working on multi-camera sitcoms,
mm-hmm.
right, which are basically filmed plays.
Right, with the live audience.
Exactly. That requires an almost architectural understanding of dialogue, blocking, how to build jokes for that live studio audience.
Mm-hmm.
Marshall, coming from joke writing and, you know, the stage influence from his mom, he would have brought that sharp ear for dialogue, for comedic timing. Bilson, presumably, complemented this perfectly. And together, they learned how to craft these episodic stories that developed characters week after week while still delivering strong, self-contained comedy narratives. Their collaboration taught Marshall how to write for established stars, huge stars like Dick Van Dyke, Lucille Ball.
Wow.
Understanding their strengths, how to tailor material so they'd really shine. This deep dive, this immersion in the craft on these major network hits,
yeah.
It was essentially his PhD in sitcom creation. It solidified his understanding of character, plot, audience engagement, all specifically for television.
And this consistent success as a writer, it eventually led to his first major step into shaping entire shows, moving beyond just, you know, contributing script.
Right, at this level.
His first TV series as a creator-producer was Hey, Landlord. It ran for one season, 1966-67. This wasn't just about writing episodes anymore. This was building the world, defining the tone, overseeing the whole creative vision, managing the people.
A whole different ballgame.
Totally. It marked a significant evolution in his career, moving from being a really talented writer to someone who truly started to architect the shows he worked on. His first producing assignment actually came with Hey, Landlord in 66. Then he produced The Lucy Show in 67. Critical stepping stones, learning the ropes of actually creating a show.
Taking on that creator-producer role is a monumental leap from just being a writer. It signifies moving from contributing to a vision to actually crafting and realizing that vision from the ground up.
Yeah.
With Hey, Landlord, Marshall wasn't just writing. He was involved in casting, budget, hiring, managing staff, dealing with network execs, ensuring the show's overall cohesion.
Everything.
Everything. This trial by fire for a show that, you know, despite its potential, only lasted one season. That would have been invaluable.
You learn from the failures too, right?
Absolutely. He likely learned critical lessons about what makes a show sustainable, how to pivot, how to maintain a vision when the network's interfering, the sheer challenge of putting a consistent product on air every single week. These are the lessons you don't get from writing jokes.
No.
They come from that immersive, often exhausting experience of leadership in a creative business.
It was the crucial practical experience he needed to lay the groundwork for that massive sitcom empire he'd build in the next decade, establishing his signature style, his understanding of how to make a show connect with a mass audience, not just for a season, but for years.
Right. So moving into the 1970s, Gary Marshall's trajectory just really took off. And one of his most crucial early successes as a showrunner was adapting Neil Simon's brilliant, iconic stage play, The Odd Couple, for television.
Yes, a huge challenge.
The play itself is just a masterclass in character dynamics, witty dialogue. Adapting that for TV, that's no small feat.
Not at all. It must have taught him so much about character development, those comedic dynamics, stuff he carried forward. The show, it ran from 1970 to 75, took those beloved, hilariously mismatched characters, Oscar Madison and Felix Unger, and brought their cohabitation chaos to a whole new, much broader audience every week.
It's a truly fascinating moment in his career, that adaptation. The distinct challenge of translating a theatrical piece which relies on nuanced dialogue, stage presence, the sustained attention of a live audience
Right.
into the faster-paced, more visually driven medium of a multi-camera TV sitcom, it's immense. Neil Simon's humor often comes from that verbal sparring, the character neuroses.
Very verbal.
Very verbal. Marshall had to keep the essence of Simon's sharp wit, his character depth, but make it accessible and engaging for a weekly TV audience that might not catch every subtle line.
So how did he do it?
Well, he often opened up the play, add more visual gags, externalize some of the character's internal struggles, crafted scenarios that fit the episodic format better than a continuous narrative arc. He understood the need for clear, digestible comedic beats for television.
Gotcha.
His success with The Odd Couple really showed his acute understanding of adaptation, proving his talent for identifying successful stories and then reimagining them for a different platform. And it's also worth noting, his sister, Penny Marshall, had that recurring role on The Odd Couple.
Right, as Myrna, Oscar's secretary.
Exactly. That was an early, significant instance of that ongoing family collaboration that became such a signature of his work. It reinforced that whole family on set feeling that really started at home for him.
That adaptation, which became this beloved classic in its own right, it really set the stage for what became Marshall's golden age of sitcoms, a period where he didn't just create household names. He shaped an entire generation's view of Americana and launched this whole universe of interconnected stories and characters.
Yeah, it was huge.
The undisputed crown jewel of this era was Happy Days. Premiered in 74, ran for a phenomenal 10 years until 1984.
10 years.
This ABC sitcom didn't just rise to fame, it exploded. It made him a household name, cemented his reputation as a hitmaker who just got the national pulse. Happy Days had this massive cultural impact, transporting millions of viewers back to this idealized 1950s.
Right, that nostalgia factor again.
Totally. It defined a generation's view of that era with its wholesome humor, relatable characters, incredibly catchy themes. Everybody knew Fonzie, Richie, the whole gang. It truly became a cultural touchstone.
Yeah, we connect this to the bigger picture. Happy Days wasn't just a show, it was a phenomenon, a masterstroke of kind of cultural engineering that tapped into this powerful yearning for nostalgia during a pretty turbulent decade, the 70s.
Good point.
So what was it about Marshall's storytelling that resonated so deeply with audiences decade after decade, to the point where jump the shark became a phrase everyone understands, mm-hmm. right? It was his ability to create characters who felt like family. The Cunninghams became America's surrogate parents and siblings. He presented situations that were universally understood, blended with just enough escapism. The show offered this comforting, optimistic view of the past that was like a balm for the anxieties of the 1970s.
It really was comfort TV.
Absolutely. Marshall's genius here was his keen observation of American life and his unique ability to translate that into broadly appealing, feel-good entertainment. He understood the nuances of creating an ensemble where every character, from the leads down to supporting players like Arnold or Mrs. C, contributed to the show's warmth and humor. He built a world viewers wanted to live in week after week. That ensured its enduring place in TV history.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting and truly shows his vision beyond just making one hit show. Marshall didn't just create Happy Days. He expanded that universe. He created these hugely successful spin-offs that launched even more iconic characters and stars. It shows an early understanding of that shared universe idea before it was really a common thing.
Absolutely. Very ahead of its time in that way.
Laverne and Shirley, which he also created and executive produced, famously starred his sister Penny Marshall alongside Cindy Williams. Two wisecracking working-class friends in 1950s Milwaukee. Another massive hit, often beating its parent show in the ratings, and of course showcased that continued family collaboration.
Right.
Then came Mork and Mindy, another iconic creation, which literally launched the career of the alien, Robin Williams, into superstardom.
Yeah, Minun.
Exactly. Imagine launching Robin Williams like that. That's some serious foresight. It speaks volumes about Marshall's eye for talent and his ability to craft characters and scenarios that would just capture the public's imagination, even if they were, you know, from another planet.
The creation of those spinoffs really illustrates Marshall's unparalleled business acumen right alongside his creative genius. He understood audiences formed these deep attachments to characters and worlds, and that extending those provided this rich pipeline for new hits. With Laverne and Shirley, he leveraged Penny Marshall's popularity, built a whole series around the relatable, often zany lives of two women trying to make it.
Yeah.
That showed his skill in character development and his trust in his sister's comedic talent.
Yeah.
Then Mork and Mindy. That was a much more audacious gamble. Robin Williams, fresh off that Happy Days guest spot as Mork, was this whirlwind of unpredictable energy, improvisational brilliance.
Totally unique.
Most producers might have tried to rein that in, right? But Marshall did the opposite. He created a framework that allowed Williams to just flourish, understanding that his unique talent was the show's biggest asset. That demonstrates Marshall's courage, his willingness to take creative risks, and his exceptional skill in recognizing and nurturing raw, transformative talent.
That's a really profound point, knowing when to frame talent versus when to just let it explode. Hmm. And this wasn't just about individual creative projects. His role as executive producer on these shows and others like Blansky's Beauties, Angie, Makin' It, it highlights his incredible capacity for building and leading successful teams.
Mm-hmm.
He forged these key collaborations with associates like Thomas L. Miller, Robert L. Boyette, Edward K. Milkus on these productions. This wasn't just a singular vision. It was like a collaborative engine, a well-oiled machine. It showed his skill not only in creative generation, but also in strategic management, mentorship. He was like a conductor, wasn't he? Orchestrating these pop culture symphonies.
Indeed.
Yeah.
His leadership style, often described as warm, approachable, highly collaborative, it feels like a direct extension of that family-oriented upbringing. He fostered an environment where talent felt comfortable, supported, encouraged to contribute.
That makes a difference.
Huge difference. It meant not just hiring talented writers and directors, but also empowering his production partners to take ownership, learn, grow.
Mm-hmm.
For example, he let his creative teams develop and shape spin-off concepts, trusting their instincts while providing that overarching guidance. He understood that a consistent quality product came from a strong, loyal team, and he treated his crews and casts like an extended family. This approach, where everyone felt invested and valued, contributed significantly to the sustained success of his sitcom empire. It's why so many actors and crew members worked with him again and again. He wasn't just a boss. He was a mentor, a friend. And that goodwill, I think, translated directly into the warmth and authenticity that just permeated his shows.
So after pretty much dominating the television landscape for, what, well over a decade, Gary Marshall, with that characteristic ambition, he set his sights on a new horizon. He shifted his focus to directing feature films in the early 1980s.
The next big step.
It was a significant transition, moving from that fast-paced, episodic world of TV with its weekly deadlines, smaller budgets, to the more expansive cinematic storytelling of movies, which demanded a different kind of vision, a different pacing.
Exactly, a different rhythm.
It's a leap many successful TV directors try, but honestly, few master it with the same consistency Marshall did. And with this new chapter came one of the most enduring and frankly endearing collaborations in Hollywood history.
Ah, yes. The transition from TV to features. It presents unique challenges. On TV, you're often working with a tight schedule, limited takes, rapid turnaround, telling a story in these short, digestible chapters.
Right.
Film, though, allows for a broader canvas, more intricate visual storytelling, a slower, more deliberate pace. Marshall had to learn to think cinematically, you know, using wider shots, more elaborate set pieces, a different rhythm of storytelling that could sustain a two-hour narrative.
But he managed it.
He did. And he successfully brought his signature strengths from TV, his knack for character development, sharp dialogue, the profound understanding of comedic timing. He didn't abandon his roots. He adapted them. Which brings us to that fascinating story of his friendship with actor Hector Elizondo.
Oh, I love this story.
Marshall met Elizondo playing basketball, of all things.
He's just playing hoops.
Yeah. And their connection was so strong, so immediate, that Elizondo basically became a fixture in Marshall's film career.
It's one of those legendary Hollywood friendships, isn't it? It just transcends the typical professional relationship. You've got to admire that kind of loyalty, that creative partnership. Elizondo appeared in every single film Marshall directed.
Every single one.
Starting with his very first feature, Young Doctors in Love in 1982. It sounds like something right out of one of his movies, doesn't it?
It really does.
That trust, that camaraderie, it must have created this incredibly fertile ground for creativity on set. Elizondo himself famously quipped that he is written into all of Marshall's contracts, whether he wanted to do the film or not.
Oh, that's great.
And as a fun little Easter egg in the opening credits of Exit to Eden, their eighth film together, Elizondo is credited with, as usual, Hector Elizondo.
Love that. What's truly fascinating here, though, is not just the consistency of their collaboration, but what it implies about Marshall's working style. That deeply ingrained sense of trust, familiarity, maybe a family-like atmosphere on set that echoed his own upbringing.
Yeah, that tracks.
Elizondo wasn't just a familiar face. He was like a muse, a sounding board, a constant presence that gave Marshall this reliable, comedic, and dramatic foil. It suggests his creative process really valued those established relationships, fostering an environment where actors felt comfortable, understood, truly part of an ensemble.
Like a safety net, almost.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Having a trusted actor who intuitively got his vision, his timing, his preferred style of performance, it allowed Marshall to direct more efficiently, achieve a consistent tone across his films. And this loyalty, it extended beyond Elizondo. You often saw recurring crew members, other actors, contributing to that stable, positive working environment that became a hallmark of his sets. So, following Young Doctors in Love, Marshall kept building his filmography, honing his big screen voice. He had early successes like The Flamingo Kid in 84, charming coming-of-age story he wrote and directed it, starred Matt Dillon.
Great movie.
And Elizondo actually had his biggest role with Marshall in that one, playing Dillon's father.
Yeah.
Really showcasing their bond. Then he followed that up with Nothing in Common in 86. More poignant drama, Tom Hanks, Jackie Gleason.
Wow, Gleason too.
Yeah, and the beloved cult classic comedy Overboard in 87 with Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell. These films really showed his ability to craft engaging stories for the big screen, blending humor with a genuine emotional depth.
Those early films were so crucial in establishing Marshall's cinematic voice, weren't they? Showing his versatility across genres, from light comedy to more dramatic stuff. The Flamingo Kid, especially, highlighted that dual talent as a writer and director, delivering a story with both humor and heart, much like his best TV work. The progression from broad comedies like Young Doctors to films with deeper emotional resonance like Nothing in Common, it showed this growing sophistication in his storytelling for the big screen. He was learning how to adapt that beloved character-driven approach from TV to the demands of a two-hour film.
Mm-hmm.
But here's where it gets really interesting. Where Gary Marshall truly became a titan of the big screen, almost single-handedly crafting the blueprint for the modern romantic comedy.
Yeah.
And that blueprint, of course, began with the absolute phenomenon that was Pretty Woman in 1990.
Pretty Woman. It wasn't just a hit. It became the seminal romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. It redefined the genre. Became a cultural touchstone, catapulted Julia Roberts and Richard Gere into, like, megastardom.
Absolutely.
Marshall's blueprint, it involves several key ingredients. He took a classic fairy tale structure, the Cinderella story, and updated it for a contemporary audience, making it feel fresh, relatable.
Even though the premise was pretty wild.
Totally wild. The film apparently started as a much darker, grittier drama called 3000. Marshall transformed it into this sparkling, optimistic, ultimately aspirational romance. His touch was so evident in the film's balance of humor, genuine emotion, aspirational romance, making it funny and deeply heartfelt.
He found that sweet spot.
He did. Yeah. He understood the formula for escapism that resonated so deeply with viewers. And he executed it perfectly, impeccable casting, extracting that electric chemistry from his leads, a keen eye for iconic scenes.
The shopping spree, the opera.
Exactly. Instantly memorable. And the critical recognition, Oscar nomination, BAFTA nominations and a win, Golden Globe nominations and a win, it cemented its status as more than just a box office smash. It was a culturally significant film that set a new standard for the genre. He basically crafted a template that so many films tried to copy, and frankly, few succeeded in replicating that magic.
He really did craft the blueprint for the modern rom-com. Think about how many films try to capture that Pretty Woman magic after he did it. And following that massive success, Marshall continued his reign as the romantic comedy king, directing other successful films that further solidified his brand.
Kept it going.
You had Beaches in 1988, beautiful blend of comedy and drama about lifelong friendship. Bette Midler, Barbara Hershey. That was actually a hit before Pretty Woman, setting the stage maybe.
Good point, yeah.
Then Frankie and Johnny in 91, a more grounded, kind of gritty romance with Al Pacino and Michelle Pfeiffer, showing his range. He even reunited Julia Roberts and Richard Gere for Runaway Bride in 99.
Trying to recapture the magic.
And it worked. Another commercial success, showing the enduring appeal of that duo under his direction. Then he found a whole new generation of fans with The Princess Diaries in 2001 and its sequel, The Princess Diaries 2, Royal Engagement in 2004, Anne Hathaway, Julie Andrews.
Huge hits.
He truly understood the magic of the fairy tale, didn't he? Whether modern or classic.
What's striking is Marshall's consistency in creating characters audiences just wanted to root for, even in really varied settings. Beaches, while pre-Pretty Woman, like you said, it set the stage for his ability to handle emotional depth within that comedic framework.
Right.
Frankie and Johnny showcased a more mature, less fantastical side of romance, proving he could navigate darker tones while still giving his characters humanity and warmth. And the Princess Diaries films, a masterclass in introducing new talent, much like he did with Robin Williams, and presenting another modern fairy tale for a new generation. Captivated audiences of all ages.
Yeah.
His success here, it wasn't accidental. It was built on his deep understanding of archetypes, his ability to draw authentic performances from actors, and his unerring instinct for stories that offer both laughter and genuine heart.
And as his career went on, Marshall developed this unique approach to ensemble casts, interconnected storylines, particularly in his later works. He directed that series of holiday-themed romantic comedies.
Ah, yes, the holiday ensembles.
Valentine's Day in 2010, New Year's Eve in 2011, and Mother's Day in 2016. These films brought together this galaxy of stars, weaving multiple narratives together around a central holiday theme.
A lot of stars.
So many stars. And while they were incredibly popular with audiences, it's also worth acknowledging the full spectrum of his career here. These films sometimes got a different critical reception. New Year's Eve even got him a Golden Raspberry nomination for Worst Director.
The Razzies, right?
Yeah. It really paints a picture of a career that had these massive highs and, well, maybe a few holiday-themed bumps along the way, but the sheer volume, the longevity, it speaks for itself.
It's important to look at those later films in context, I think. While maybe not critical darlings, their commercial success really underscored Marshall's enduring appeal and his ability to draw top-tier talent.
True.
And it raises a question. Why did he keep making them, despite those mixed reviews? Well, Marshall understood these films filled a specific niche. Star-studded, feel-good entertainment, perfect for a holiday release.
Comfort food cinema, maybe?
Exactly. His consistent focus on human connection, albeit sometimes stretched a bit thin across all those storylines and lighthearted entertainment, allowed him to maintain such a prolific, celebrated career, even as movie trends evolved. He wasn't chasing critical acclaim with those films so much as delivering a specific experience to a loyal audience.
Yeah.
He was providing that warm, predictable, optimistic escape, reminiscent of the wholesome entertainment he pioneered on TV.
Mm.
The Razzie nomination, in a way, is almost a testament to the sheer volume of his output, his willingness to keep creating, even if not every project was a critical home run. A long, prolific career will always have peaks and valleys, right? But his overall record of sustained success, commercially and culturally, is truly exceptional. It underscores that even with a stumble, the overall legacy just shines brightly and continues to inspire.
And beyond his monumental achievements as a writer, producer, director, Gary Marshall was also an actor. He regularly stepped in front of the camera himself.
Yeah, he popped up everywhere.
He wasn't just calling the shots. He loved being part of the performance, immersing himself in the storytelling from another angle. He had numerous film roles, often memorable supporting parts that showcased that genial personality, that perfect comedic timing.
Mm-hmm.
You might remember him as the dry-witted casino manager in Albert Brooks's brilliant Lost in America in 85.
Oh, yeah, great role.
Or in Jumpin' Jack Flash in 86, he popped up in Soap Dish in 91. And continuing that incredible family dynamic, he played the gruff but lovable studio exec Walter Harvey in A League of Their Own in 92, directed by his sister Penny. A wonderful role reversal.
That's fantastic.
They even appeared together, hilariously, in Hocus Pocus in 93. He was the devil husband to Penny's devil wife.
Ah, forgot about that.
Later, he was in Orange County in 2002 as Arthur Gantner and Life After Beth in 2014 as Grandpa. He was literally everywhere. From a casino manager to a cartoon chicken. He just loved to perform, be part of the storytelling.
It really raises an important question, doesn't it? How did his experiences as an actor inform his directing? One might speculate that having walked in an actor's shoes gave him this unique perspective on performance, on character. Being on the other side of the camera, understanding the challenges, the nuances of delivering a performance, the vulnerability involved, it undoubtedly made him a more patient, empathetic, insightful director. He knew what it felt like to be in front of the camera, what kind of direction was helpful, how to create a safe, supportive environment for actors to really thrive. This likely contributed to the strong, authentic, often very human acting we see in his films.
Makes total sense.
His recurring role is Mr. Stan Lansing on Murphy Brown. 24 episodes. That's a prime example of him embracing a consistent character in a celebrated ensemble.
Big role on a big show.
Exactly. Yeah. Beyond that, guest appearances on iconic shows. Popped up in Happy Days twice as a drummer fun, meta nod to his own creation.
Love that.
Even on The Odd Couple, the show he helped adapt, lent his distinctive voice to The Simpsons twice, playing characters like Mr. Larry Kidkill, Sheldon Leavitt, showing his versatility. He was also seen on Monk, Sabrina, The Teenage Witch, 2 1/2 Men, Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Wow.
His final on-screen appearance was, fittingly, on The Odd Couple Revival in 2016, playing Walter Madison, bringing his career full circle.
And it wasn't just live action. Marshall's voice was also featured in animated films, even video games. Shows his embrace of every modern storytelling medium available, right?
Totally.
He contributed vocal talents to The Majestic in 2001 and famously voiced Buck Cluck, the often exasperated dad and the narrator in Disney's Chicken Little in 2005.
Buck Cluck, right.
He even reprised the role for the Chicken Little video game. It just goes to show how much he enjoyed every facet of storytelling and performance, truly embracing the full spectrum of entertainment. He just loved to create, be a part of the creative process.
His prolific acting career, whether on screen or through voice, it further reinforces his deep understanding of storytelling from all angles. He wasn't just a director instructing. He was an artist who knew what it felt like to be directed, to inhabit a character.
Right.
This holistic view undoubtedly enriched his approach to filmmaking, television production, allowed him to communicate with actors on a different level. It speaks to a genuine, unadulterated love for the craft itself, not just the prestige of being at the helm. He loved the collaborative energy, the camaraderie, the simple joy of performance, much like he loved that family atmosphere on his sets. It let him keep a finger on the pulse of acting and performance, continuously refreshing his understanding of the creative process.
And beyond the screen, Marshall also had this strong connection to the stage, which makes perfect sense given his background adapting The Odd Couple and, of course, his mother's tap dance school way back when.
Right, back to his roots.
He delved into playwriting, contributing to works like Wrong Turn at Lungfish, which he wrote with Lowell Ganz, and The Roast with his old writing partner, Jerry Belson.
Wow, back with Belson too.
Yeah. It's a testament to his versatility, his deep respect for the foundational art of theater, where stories are stripped down to their essential elements, character and dialogue.
Indeed.
Yeah.
His involvement in theater, it underscores this deep, fundamental respect for foundational storytelling. He recognized that a good narrative, compelling characters, witty dialogue, then they can transcend mediums.
True.
He understood that whether it's delivered on a proscenium stage, a small screen, or a cinema screen, a story's core strength is its ability to connect with an audience. And this recognition of theater as a core artistic expression is further shown by his creation of Happy Days, a new musical.
Ah, the musical.
He collaborated with the legendary songwriter Paul Williams on this project. It premiered in 2006 at the Falcon Theater in Burbank, California, a theater he himself founded.
Oh, wow. I didn't know he founded it.
Yeah. To take a beloved, iconic sitcom and successfully transform it into a Broadway-style musical, it demonstrates his belief in the enduring power of his characters and stories. It also shows his willingness to explore new ways to bring them to life, see how they'd resonate in a different format, adding music and dance to his already established comedic framework. This truly shows the breadth of his creative vision, spanning from classic sitcoms to modern rom-coms and ultimately back to the live stage, all originating from his incredible, multifaceted mind.
Gary Marshall's career wasn't just prolific, it was critically acclaimed, widely recognized across the entire entertainment industry. He racked up numerous accolades that really demonstrate the breadth and depth of his impact, cementing his place in the pantheon of American entertainment.
He really did.
In 1996, he got the Women in Film Lucy Award. That's a particularly significant one, recognizing him for enhancing the perception of women through television.
That's huge.
It was a testament to his commitment to crafting strong, relatable female characters from the working-class heroines of Laverne and Shirley to the aspirational women in Pretty Woman and The Princess Diaries. It showed a nuanced understanding of female narratives, often overlooked in mainstream comedy back then.
That Lucy Award really highlights a crucial, often subtle aspect of his storytelling. He didn't just create funny female characters. He created complex women with agency, dreams, genuine friendships, which was pretty progressive for network TV in the 70s and 80s.
Absolutely.
This was followed by his induction into the Television Hall of Fame in 1997. A fitting tribute for someone who literally built an entire sitcom empire that defined an era. Then in 2012, he was further honored with induction into the National Association of Broadcasters Broadcasting Hall of Fame. These commendations just underscore his profound influence on the TV landscape, marking him not just as a popular show creator, but as a true pioneer whose innovations, whose character-driven approach set standards for the medium.
And the recognition didn't stop there. He was highly respected by his peers as a writer, got the Valentine Davies Award in 95, the prestigious Laurel Award for TV Writing Achievement in 2014, both from the Writers Guild of America.
Awards from other writers, that means a lot.
Exactly. Acknowledging his mastery of the craft over decades of scriptwriting, from joke punch-ups to full series creation, and of course, in 1983, one of Hollywood's most iconic honors, a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame for television. Right there at 648 Hollywood BLVD, permanently etching his name into the very fabric of entertainment history.
Can't get much more iconic than that.
Right. He also garnered other significant wins. American Comedy Awards Creative Achievement in 90, Casting Society of America Lifetime Achievement in 95, two Producers Guild Awards, Lifetime Achievement Awards in 98, one for membership, one for television. It really paints a picture of a career with massive highs and, okay, maybe a few holiday-themed bumps. But the sheer volume, the longevity, it speaks for itself. He was truly a multi-hyphenate talent, celebrated across all his disciplines.
What's fascinating here is how these awards collectively illustrate his unparalleled influence across writing, directing, producing, and across different mediums. The breadth of his recognition, from celebrating his portrayal of women to his contributions to broadcasting and writing it, showcases a career that transcended trends, consistently delivered quality and impact.
Yeah.
And yes, while that Golden Raspberry nomination for New Year's Eve stands out as a contrasting note, it actually speaks to the sheer volume and incredible longevity of his output, like we said. Not every project in a decades-long career can be a critical darling.
True.
And in a career as prolific as Marshall's, there are bound to be projects that resonate more with audiences than critics. He often prioritized broad audience appeal, warmth, over critical accolades. That was a conscious choice. It humanizes his career, shows even a legend had projects that didn't quite hit every mark. But his overall record of sustained success and industry recognition, truly exceptional. It underscores that even with a stumble, the overall legacy shines brightly, continues to inspire.
Sadly, the world lost this incredible creative force on July 19th, 2016. Gary Marshall passed away at 81 in Burbank, California. Complications of pneumonia after suffering a stroke. He was cremated at Forest Lawn Hollywood Hills.
Such a loss.
But while he may be gone, his immense impact, the profound affection for him, it endures. A testament to the man he was, just as much as the work he created.
Yeah, what's truly striking is the consistency of the sentiment across all the tributes from people who knew him, worked with him. It wasn't just admiration for his work, it was genuine affection for him as a person.
You really feel that.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it suggests his impact went far beyond the screen. He created this warm, collaborative environment that fostered deep loyalty, inspired profound personal connections. It's an echo of his family-oriented upbringing, his work style. Julia Roberts, who he directed in Pretty Woman and Runaway Bride, she gave a particularly moving tribute.
Oh, yeah.
She said eloquently, "To know Gary Marshall was to love him. And I was luckier than most to have loved him for my entire adult life, and luckier still to have been loved by him because his love was unconditional, inexhaustible, and magical."
Wow, that's powerful. Speaks not just to professional mentorship, but to his incredible warmth, his humanity behind the camera. It truly speaks volumes about the kind of person he was, inspiring that deep devotion and respect from some of the biggest stars in Hollywood. And the tributes kept coming from across the industry. Henry Winkler Fonzie himself paid a heartfelt tribute on the show Barry in 2019, showcasing that lasting bond formed over decades.
Amazing.
SAG-AFTRA did a memoriam tribute at the SAG Awards in 2019, recognizing his significant contributions, not just as a director and producer, but also as an actor within the industry.
Right, acknowledging the whole picture.
Exactly. And ABC, the network that was home to so many of his iconic sitcoms, they aired a special called The Happy Days of Gary Marshall on May 12, 2020. A comprehensive celebration of his extraordinary life, his enduring legacy, bringing his story to a new generation, too.
These heartfelt tributes really underscore what many in the industry already knew. Marshall's touch was distinctive, deeply personal. He was a storyteller who infused his work with genuine warmth, infectious humor, characters that felt incredibly real, relatable, like extensions of our own families and friends.
Yeah.
His ability to connect with audiences across generations, across mediums, from the nostalgic glow of Happy Days to the modern romance of Pretty Woman, was truly unparalleled. He didn't just create entertainment. He created cultural touchstones, moments of shared joy, laughter, understanding that continue to resonate today. His legacy is one of genuine human connection, delivered with a smile, a laugh, an open heart, leaving an indelible mark on how we perceive and enjoy popular storytelling. He reminded us that at the heart of every great story is, you know, universal human truth.
So what does this all mean for us? It means that whether you grew up watching Fonzie jump the shark, or you fell in love with a modern fairy tale that started with a red dress, or you simply enjoyed a good laugh with characters who felt like family, Garry Marshall was likely the wizard behind the curtain, inviting you into his wonderfully warm and humorous world.
Nicely put.
From a persistent joke writer in New York to a television mogul who shaped an entire decade, a beloved film director who redefined romantic comedy, a character actor who loved to perform, and a playwright who never forgot his theatrical roots. His career was just a masterclass in creative versatility and consistent audience connection. His unique blend of humor, heart, collaborative spirit left this indelible mark on popular culture, shaping the entertainment landscape for decades.
Indeed. His life's work wasn't just about creating content. It was about fostering communities both on screen and behind the scenes, built on laughter, loyalty, and this deep, empathetic understanding of the human condition. He showed us the most profound stories are often found in the most relatable human experiences.
Absolutely. So as you reflect on the stories and characters that have brought you joy throughout your life, maybe consider the profound impact one individual through sheer determination, boundless creativity, and an incredible knack for human connection can have on the collective memory and joy of millions. What specific elements of Garry Marshall's storytelling do you think truly endure, and how do you see his unique touch continuing to influence the content we consume today, maybe in ways we don't even consciously realize,